Russia invites experts from the United Nations and the Red Cross to probe a recent attack on a jail in eastern Ukraine that killed dozens of Ukrainian prisoners of war. Supporters of Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr remain in the country's parliament building for a second day amid political deadlock over the formation of a new government. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran is determined to reach a good, strong, and lasting agreement in the talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. It's good to have you with us. Moscow has invited experts from the United Nations and the Red Cross to probe the deaths of dozens of Ukrainian prisoners in a jail in eastern Ukraine held by pro-Russia forces. In a statement, the defense minister said it favored an objective investigation into the attack on the prison earlier in the week. The facility in the frontline town of Olenivka, Donetsk province, was hit on Friday. Pro-Russia forces in Donetsk say that 53 Ukrainian prisoners of war were killed and dozens more wounded. Moscow accuses Kiev of attacking the prison with U.S.-made rockets to prevent Ukrainian soldiers from surrendering. Ukraine, however, denies any involvement. It says Russia conducted the raid to put the blame on Kiev. Meantime, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says that he has ordered a mandatory evacuation of people from the eastern Donetsk region.
The government decision on mandatory evacuation from the Donetsk region is in place. Everything is being organized. Full support, full assistance, both logistical and compensation. All we need is a decision from the people themselves, who have not yet made it for themselves.
In a televised speech, Zelensky said that thousands of people, including children, are still in the battleground areas of Donetsk, adding that his government will compensate those who leave the region. Donetsk has been the scene of fierce clashes between the Ukrainian forces and the Russian military in recent days. On Saturday, the warring sides traded blame over an attack that allegedly killed dozens of prisoners in a front line held by forces loyal to Russia. Moscow says Ukraine hit the prison with U.S.-made rockets, but Kiev denies the claim and says that Russia itself targeted the prison. Yemen's Minister of Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the consequences of the Saudi blockade of Yemen. During the conference, it accused the UN of ignoring Riyadh's violations of international law. Abdullatif Al-Dashali has a report from Sana'a.
Under the title Blockade on Yemen, Slow Killing of Civilians Under the UN Cover, the Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in Yemen's capital Sana'a to highlight the catastrophic repercussions of the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemen despite the UN brokered truce.
The United Nations participates directly and indirectly in the killing of the Yemeni people by its silence on the crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. Saudi Arabia is violating the terms of the UN armistice, and unfortunately the international body has not taken any action. And there are falsification of facts and allegations that the Saudi-led coalition cares about the humanitarian situation in Yemen, and this is not true.
Officials say the United Nations is responsible for the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Yemen throughout the armistice, as it has failed to force Riyadh to fulfill its obligations under the agreement.
The United Nations is the one who monitors and inspects all ships, including food, medicine, and oil ships, but it does not inspect Saudi ships that carry weapons, and all Yemeni ships are prevented from reaching the Hodeidah port. We believe that the United Nations is responsible for what happens to civilians in Yemen because of its inability to force Riyadh to abide by the terms of the armistice brokered by the international body.
Recently, Yemenis have demonstrated in front of the United Nations Envoy's office in Sana'a to criticize Riyadh's continued detention of Yemeni fuel ships amid the UN-brokered truce.
Human rights activists believe the Saudi violations of the UN-brokered truce will not stop unless the world body takes real measures against the kingdom. They say the terms of the armistice should be completely fulfilled before any extension. Abdullatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iraq remains gripped by political uncertainty as supporters of Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr continue to occupy the parliament building for a second day. Now, this is the second time that protesters have stormed the building in a week amid a deadlock over the formation of a new government. The Sadr movement says the sit-in will continue until further notice. Parliament Speaker Mohammed Al-Halbousi says that all parliamentary meetings have been suspended. According to the health ministry, at least 100 protesters and 25 security personnel have been injured in clashes. Demonstrators are opposed to the nomination of former Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani to replace Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. The Premier has urged talks to resolve the crisis.
The political blocs must sit down and negotiate and understand for the sake of Iraq and the Iraqi people. And the language of treason and exclusion must be avoided. I call on everyone to become patient and rational and not to be drawn into confrontation. And I call on citizens not to clash with the security forces and to respect the state institutions.
Iraqi political parties have also reacted to the storming of the parliament. The Fatah Alliance called for dialogue to resolve differences among political parties. The head of the National Wisdom Movement made a similar demand. Ammar al-Hakim says the political blocs should hold negotiations on the basis of preserving Iraq's national interests to tackle current problems. The bloc led by Sadr won most of the seats in the October 2021 parliament elections. But the cleric asked all the blocs MPs to resign last month after he failed to reach the two-thirds majority needed to pick a president to form a government. Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran is determined to reach a good, strong, and lasting agreement in talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made a remark during a phone call with his Qatari counterpart, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al-Thani. The top Qatar diplomat also called for the continuation of the talks between Iran and other signatories to the JCPOA until the two sides reach an agreement. Tehran says that a revival of the 2015 nuclear agreement hinges on Washington's political will to provide guarantees that Iran can reap full benefits it's entitled to under the accord. Now, Masoud Chajara, head of the London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, says that the West should not expect Iran to fulfill its JCPOA commitments if it cannot reap economic benefits of the deal.
The reality is that I think it is only right to say that if Iran is not going to benefit from economically and from removal of the sanction, then the West should not be in a position to actually expect the part of Iran to be fulfilled by the Iranian. And I just hope that we will see the end of this tit-for-tat and the United States and the West will decide to uphold its commitment so Iran could go back to its commitment also. But I think what is very obvious is that commitment cannot be one-sided.
And I'm moving on. China saying it will resolutely safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity, referring to Taiwan amid rising tensions over the self-ruled island. The Chinese Air Force says it's many types of fighter jets capable of reaching Taiwan. It says it has the firm will and sufficient capability to defend China's territory. U.S. media has recently reported that U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi could pay a visit to Taipei during her regional tour in August. Beijing says such a visit would send the wrong signal to separatist forces in Taiwan. China has opposed Washington's growing military and diplomatic ties with Taiwan, which Beijing considers as part of its territory. Now, based on official data, U.S. economy shrank for two quarters in a row, and that signals the unofficial start of a recession there, and it should be denied by President Joe Biden and White House officials. They cite positive facts, including a low unemployment rate, but that alone is not enough to push economic growth. The Federal Reserve has already raised interest rates four times this year to control inflation, which is at a 40-year high.
The U.S. economy has entered a recession. Based on the official definition of a recession, when the economy contracts for two consecutive quarters, that is the definition of a recession. Recession fears for the U.S. have been ongoing for some time. One of the factors which speeded up the decline of the economy was energy prices, which have affected the prices of goods, from food to basic stuff, leading to inflation. The U.S. is experiencing over 9% inflation, something it has not experienced in over four decades.
The American economy is being bashed from pillar to post right now by a whole range of factors, but certainly it's going into recession because there's severe headwinds being caused by, first of all, the government cutting back on its spending in a ridiculous attempt to balance its budget, which it should not be trying to do in the first place, and then high interest rates compared to what they have been in the recent past, even though they're below the rate of inflation, and meaning that households are no longer borrowing, and in fact, they're probably paying their level of debt down.
The U.S. president has been trying to portray this as a temporary phase, which the U.S. economy will overcome.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. We still find ourselves with people investing. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to steady growth.
But as things are going, especially the war in Ukraine, this is anything but temporary. The mayor of New York has painted an even bleaker picture. He has said that we are in a financial crisis like you can never imagine. Wall Street is collapsing. We are in a recession.
Now, at the beginning of this news broadcast, I told you about Iraq that's remaining in a political uncertainty. And this is the second day that supporters of Muqtada al-Sadr's are occupying the parliament building. Now, let's go live to Baghdad, Iraqi capital. Navid Behrouz, Press TV's Baghdad bureau chief, is there. And Navid, tell us about what's going on there, what exactly the problem is, and what could be done about this.
Here is the Parliament of Representatives of Iraq. It is a place where lawmakers have been here, and Mohammed al-Habrousi used to sit there until days ago, and he used to preside over the meeting. But now this building has been captured by protesters, by supporters of Muqtada al-Sadr, and these protesters are demonstrating here, and they do not allow Parliament to continue its meetings. So at the moment, these protesters are demanding a change of the constitution and holding early elections and a change of the political trend in Iraq. These protesters have come here in order to opposing the candidacy of the nominee for premier. And he is against him becoming the premier. In this place, lawmakers were supposed to hold a meeting on the candidacy, but that meeting was canceled. So this parliament, as protesters are here at this parliament, and they are supporters of cleric Muqtada Sadr. And he is waiting for him. They will not leave here until the cleric orders them to. And they have issued a statement. On the other hand, leaders of another movement are calling for dialogue and the peaceful resolution of this crisis, negotiated settlement of this crisis. Mr. Haider Abadi, Sayyid Amal al-Hakim, Sayyid al-Rahman, they all want a dialogue in order to resolve this crisis. Until now, the Sadr movement has not responded positively to this demand, and they are against the candidacy of the nominee for the premier, and this crisis lingers on. We have not ever seen such a crisis before in Iraq. There is a serious concern here, and the other party opposing the Sadr movement may stage a similar demonstration as well, and that will add to the crisis. And so the two sides, crisis between the two sides could increase, and the crisis could enter a new era and could become actually more severe. Maybe a temporary government will take hold, will take power, no one knows. And still, everything is mired in this crisis for the now.
Okay, that was Naveed Behrouz, Press TV's Baghdad bureau chief for us. In Baghdad, in the parliament building, which is being occupied by the Sadr supporters for a couple of days. Okay, with that, we come to the end of this broadcast from Tehran.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
Listeners Special. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special. On this Sunday, July 31st, 2022. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. As you may know, Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails and letters. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, and then you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Dear listeners, as the Islamic month of Muharram has arrived, mourning ceremonies and gatherings are held across the Islamic countries and other countries where Muslim communities live. Nearly 14 centuries have passed since the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, but every year, mourning ceremonies across the world are held more fervently than the previous year. On behalf of all IRIB English Radio staff, I express my condolences on the mourning month of Muharram. Please stay with your program, Listeners Special. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. These reception reports actually enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card from your radio station, IRIB English Radio, and your program Listeners Special. And here I truly appreciate those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Ahmad Farid from India, Nestor Di Fischetto from Argentina, and Nico Genovese from Italy. So Ahmad Farid, Nico Genovese, and Nestor Di Fischetto, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to your radio, IRIB English Radio. And of course, we've received a lot of emails and letters from around the world, which I mention some of their names here. And later during the program, I will read these emails. Anjum Hussein, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us an email. Suti Kati from India has sent us an email. We've received an email from Muhammad Khaku, one of our old and regular listeners from the U.S. Pekka Lito Puja from Finland has sent us an email. I wish I'm right in pronouncing your name because I don't know Finnish. The last but not the least is an email from Ali Hassan from Bangladesh. So, dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with these great emails. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Anjum Hussein, one of our old and regular listeners from Kashmir, has sent us an email. Anjum Hussein says, Salam and condolences on the occasion of the month of Muharram. I am a regular listener and I like and learn from all the programs you broadcast, especially the ones focusing on morals and ethics and Islamic teachings. Enlightening us on socio-political issues is also very good measure. I will be writing to you more soon. First of all, salam and warmest greetings to you, Anjum Hussein from Kashmir. And we also do express our condolences on the occasion of the mourning month of Muharram to you and all our listeners around the world. Thank you very much for sending us this message on the occasion of the month of Muharram and also showing your attitudes and ideas on the programs of IRIB English Radio. Thank you for that. Anjum Hussein from Kashmir, we will soon send you an electronic QSL card as a confirmation. Anjum Hussein, we are looking forward to hearing from you soon. Thank you again. And Suti Kati from India has sent us an email. Suti Kati says, there was a time when I received this type of magazines of Iran via post, but it's been a while I haven't received this magazine from your side. That's very much upsetting for us since I have kept each and everything that you had sent me for almost 10 years. Best wishes for all the broadcasters and listeners. I listen to your program via your Android app. Looking forward to hearing from you. Salam and warm greetings to you, Suti Kati from India, and many thanks for sending us this piece of email. So you used to receive magazines from IRIB English Radio, and as you may know, Suti Kati from India, you are one of our old and regular listeners, and you should know that we used to send our dear listeners materials like souvenirs, like magazines, like postcards, like paper QSL cards. But after the spreading of this virus and the prevailing pandemic around the world, we can't send any material to our listeners. Unfortunately, for the time being, please accept our electronic QSL card because sending any post or mail is not possible because of the pandemic. So we should send anything, by email, something like electronic stuff. So after the pandemic is over, of course, we resume sending you the magazines you used to receive and any material or souvenirs of IRIB English Radio. Sorry for that. So you listen to our programs via app, and that's great. Suti Kati from India, many thanks for sending us this email and reflecting your views about our programs. Write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you soon. And after a short break, I will be back with an email from Muhammad Khaku, one of our old and regular listeners. Welcome back. Muhammad Khaku from the U.S., one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us an email. Muhammad says, the month of grief and sorrow, Muharram, has arrived. Muharram is the month of epic heroism and self-sacrifice, the month in which truth condemned falsehood and branded the mark of disgrace upon the forehead of all oppressors. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, did not struggle for worldly gain or power, but only to reform the community or ummah of his grandfather, and not to pledge allegiance to Yazid, the oppressor of the time. He preferred to die rather than compromise with injustice and oppression. Such clarity of vision, purpose, and commitment is lacking in the world today. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Muhammad Khaku from the U.S., and please accept our appreciations to you for sending us this email and your great description of the struggle of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and his companions. Please accept our condolences for the mourning month of Muharram, and thank you for sending us this email. As you said, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, did not struggle for worldly gain or power, but only to reform the community of his grandfather, Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you said, such clarity of vision, purpose, and commitment is lacking in today's world. Muhammad Khaku from the U.S., again, thank you for sending us this email. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And from Finland, we've received an email from Pekka Litopoja, one of our regular listeners. Pekka says, dear friends, I listened to your program a few days ago here in Kuvola in southern Finland. Reception of your program was quite good. I would be very happy if you could verify that I have heard right and this signal was originally from your station transmitter. I am 66 years old and have had this hobby since I was 12 years old. Now I am retired and I have started again this hobby. With best regards. Salam and warm greetings to you, Pekka from Finland. Thank you for writing to your radio, IRIB English Radio, and your favorite program, Listeners Special. We are so happy that the signals of IRIB English Radio are received in southern Finland, in Kuvola, you said. You live in Kuvola, and that's great. And it's good to hear that the reception of IRIB English radio programs was quite good. Please tell us your views about our broadcast, Pekka from Finland. Tell us which program or programs you like the best, Pekka. Write us soon. Thank you again. My colleagues will soon send you an electronic QSL card as a confirmation. And after a short break, I will be back with an email from Bangladesh from Ali Hassan. Welcome back. As I said, Ali Hassan from Bangladesh has sent us an email. Ali Hassan says, after a long time, I started listening to your station again. Now I am one of your regular listeners. I love to listen to radio programs. Please send me your program's schedule. Radio listening and collecting postcards are my favorite hobbies. Also, I would love to receive some souvenirs from your radio station, such as QSL cards, postcards, or other items that you send to your listeners. Thank you. Ali Hassan from Bangladesh, salam and warm greetings to you. Thank you for sending us this email. Please accept our warm gratitudes for sending us this email. So you are one of our regular listeners. As you may know, Ali Hassan from Bangladesh, sending any material, including QSL, paper QSL cards, postcards, or any material on behalf of IRIB English Radio to our great listeners is not possible at the time of pandemic. So please accept our electronic QSL card as a confirmation. And maybe after the pandemic, we will resume sending souvenirs of IRIB English Radio to our great listeners around the world. Ali Hassan from Bangladesh, many thanks for sending us this email. Write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you soon. Dear listeners, before we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, again, on behalf of all IRIB English Radio staff, I express my condolences on the mourning month of Muharram. Please keep in touch with us and have a good time.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran has issued a warning about Israel's nuclear arsenal, in particular its nuclear warheads, which is estimated to number between 200 to 400. This is while Israel has not only been claiming that Iran is just a short time away from obtaining the bomb, it has also threatened Iran with military action. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how it is that Israel and not Iran, who is a threat not only to the Islamic Republic, but also to the West Asia region as a whole. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Marseille, France. Also joining us, former U.S. government advisor Paul LaRudy, who joins us from Berkeley.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Paul and Rudy, I'm going to first start with you. I'm curious as to why Israel is pursuing a policy of what they call deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, when it is very well known that it does possess between 200 to 400 of them, warheads in particular. Not only the former U.S. President Jimmy Carter has said that, but you also have that whistleblower, Vanunu, who has claimed that. But why does it pursue this policy of what it calls nuclear ambiguity?
There's a very simple answer to that, and that is that the U.S. Congress has passed, the U.S. government has passed legislation saying that the U.S. cannot provide aid of any kind to any country that possesses nuclear weapons and develops nuclear weapons. Therefore, since this is an agreement between Israel and the United States, and the State Department of the United States every year certifies that they have no evidence that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, in which case it is permissible to provide Israel with aid. That's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. There are other reasons that Israel considers it advantageous, but this is the main one that began decades ago.
Like, what are the reasons that it does not want to claim that you said are advantageous for not stating it?
Well, they can't be held in non-compliance with various international treaties if they don't belong to those treaties, and if they supposedly don't have nuclear weapons, and they can't be held accountable, I think, on a variety of metrics, means of judging them. They can't be held accountable if it's not certain that they have these weapons.
Okay, Elijah Magner, so we have what Iran has stated, and many are also questioning as to why you have the NPT, and when you have the threat that are posed by nuclear weapons, that Israel, which again, even though they don't want to admit it, but have 200 to 400 of these nuclear warheads, are not a member of the NPT. Iran says it should be a member of the NPT, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. And the big question is, why isn't the IAEA actually fulfilling its responsibility in this regard to pursue this matter with Israel? Of course, Iran is saying that because it's also being threatened by Israel militarily. But above and beyond that, Israel keeps accusing Iran of pursuing a path towards weaponizing its nuclear program.
Thank you for having me. The answer is quite simple. The IAEA was formed in 1957. By the Americans. And since the 1957, the Israelis were engaged at the beginning with building a nuclear reactor with the help of France, Norway, and the Americans. And since then, the IAEA never inspected the Israeli nuclear plant. It was only later when Ben-Gurion admitted that the Dimona was hosting what used to be a textile factory, in fact, was a nuclear reactor. And the reason why the Israelis said for the first time, we're talking about in 1962, 1963, when they admitted the first time that they may have developed a nuclear weapons in their what used to be called textile factory, only deterrent to Arab actions against Israel. So since then, the Americans have created the Atom for Peace program at the time of President Eisenhower and camouflaged the Israeli reactor and the Israeli development of nuclear weapons. It was since then that the Americans planned to hide what the Israelis are doing to prevent the IAEA that was formed by the Americans to go and inspect what the Israelis have and to make sure that the public and the world is aware of the Israeli nuclear capability. Instead, they've hidden all that. The French has hidden all that. Norway hidden all that. And they all aware, the international community is aware, because they have, Norway provided 20 tons of water for the reactor, and France provided the reactor. So they all know what's happening in Israel. They all know about the weapon that Israel have. And also, we know that the Israelis were about to use nuclear weapon during the 6 days war with the Arabs. So now, failing to expose all that and to open the site to international community and international supervision, it shows us first that international supervision is not international, but is under the thumb of the Americans. Second, that everything the Israelis are doing is covered and supported by the Americans. Third, it's a cherry picking for the Americans to go and accuse Iran and Korea and China and the countries that are not friendly to the US and push the IAEA to go and inspect what they are doing with the nuclear reactor, if it is for peace or for weapon purposes.
Well, one of the things that happens when you have a nuclear reactor is the fact that it poses a threat or a danger to the environment, Paula Rudy. And given the fact that it's not under the IAEA supervision, as we understand, that this in particular obviously provides a threat to the West Bank. You have nuclear waste that it is alleged that the Israel is burying in the West Bank. Shouldn't that be a matter of concern?
Of course it's a matter of concern, especially to the Palestinians themselves. But this is, again, nothing new. Israel has used the occupied territories as a dumping ground for all sorts of toxic waste and materials. And they consider this a way of continuing the genocide of the Palestinians, destroying the Palestinian people, at least those that are, well, in general, the Palestinian people, both those who are under their direct rule and those that are not, even outside. They've done similar things in Lebanon, for example, and Syria and so forth. They consider it an advantage to be able to put toxic materials where they want to make life miserable, difficult, and even to end life for the people that they want to get rid of. So this is just part of their policy of genocide.
You had an idea that came up during the former president, Iranian president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Elijah Magnier, and that was a West Asia or Middle East free zone, as he called it during that time. And just recently, again, Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN has drawn attention to this establishment of a zone free of WMDs, weapons of mass destruction, of which it was actually initiated by Iran at the UN. Israel is against that, does not want that. Coming from Iran and the fact that Israel does not want that, what message is that sending?
Iran is sending a message that the Middle East, as the rest of the world, should be free of weapons of mass destruction. However, this is not what the Americans want. So if we look at all the American administrations, starting from Eisenhower to Kennedy to Johnson to Nixon, they all hide and hid all the Israeli capability for one purpose, is to keep a deterrence in the Middle East against the U.S. allies, against the U.S. enemies. So when Iran is coming out with a proposal saying we want the Middle East without weapons of mass destruction, is really targeting only Israel because it's the only place where there are weapons of mass destruction. And this goes against the U.S. and the Israeli policy that want Israel to remain the policeman of the region, which is not something that Iran accepts. And also all the countries where there is a population that stands against the normalization with Israel and refuse what the Israeli did by occupying the Palestinian territory. So by Iran saying, I want this, a Middle East or an area or half of the world or whatever free of weapons of mass destruction, it goes against the U.S. and the Israeli policy that the U.S. will certainly refuse to abide by and will completely ignore the call for weapons of mass destruction, which is obviously that is directed only toward Israel. And the Americans are not ready to compromise anything what they call the security of the Israelis.
Paula Rudy, I think you also had a response to that.
Mr. Meunier is exactly correct. And the United States does not want to give up an advantage or the advantage of its ally, or Israel is just basically an extension of the United States, or you could say the United States is an extension of Israel, if you like. But they have an advantage, which are the nuclear weapons, and they can always threaten others with them and cause problems, as we've already discussed. So they want to keep that advantage, and the idea of a nuclear-free or a nuclear weapons-free Middle East is they're not willing to consider it, and they don't have to, because they're the power in the region.
But when you take a look at Israel, Elijah Magnier, Israel is the only entity right now that is not only attacking a sovereign nation repeatedly, namely Syria. It has actually attacked Syria's nuclear facilities at one point in order to, based on its views, to stop the further investment of its nuclear program. At the same time, it is threatening Iran militarily. So when you have an entity that is reacting that way and carries out operations like that, military operations, isn't then Israel at the highest risk of proliferation or using nuclear weapons?
Indeed, it is. Israel did not attack Syria's site only. It has attacked also Iraq in the 80s to stop Iraq from developing its nuclear capability. So any country that stands as strong in competition with Israel, Israel reacts to it with the full support of the United States of America. Now, Israel represents a danger because the Israelis are really looking to attack any country that, for them, can create a threat to Israel. Now, the only threat in the region is Israel itself, to violate the Lebanese air space, to violate Syrian airspace, to bomb Lebanon, to bomb Syria, to bomb Iraq. They bombed many sites of the Hashd al-Shaabi and the Iraqi security forces, attacks in Iran and assassination. So it's Israel that is taking always initiative and is the first aggressor. Now, as long as it has what Israel called the deterrence, a nuclear deterrence, at the end of the day, I don't think this is a point of strength for Israel, because we've seen how Russia in Ukraine was not able to use its nuclear weapons. However, that doesn't justify that Israel needs to go unchecked and for the world to keep looking the other way about what the Israelis are doing and what are their nuclearity is in the Negev and the Dimona, and what they are doing there and how they are developing, and if that represents a danger to the civilian population.
Well, you have obviously one of the most important standoffs that can occur because of the way that Israel acts, and that is when it comes to Iran. We have seen what Israel has done in terms of acts of sabotage against Iran, from the assassinations of a number of nuclear scientists to facilities itself, which the most recent one was in Karaj. And one of the most recent developments also was how an Israeli spy cell was actually caught. And one of the revelations was that they wanted to lay bombs at a sensitive site in Esfahan, which, according to one report, they had already gone through and done that. So aren't these all signs that there needs to be some restriction, some oversight then, back to the question through the relevant organization, which at this point is the IAEA, in order to stop anything from happening?
Well, neither the IAEA nor the United Nations nor any other organization is going to stop Israel from doing whatever it feels like doing, as long as it feels that it has the power to do it without consequences to itself. And that's unfortunately the situation, and it's the situation of its sponsor, the United States as well. It will, both entities will do whatever they can to make others subservient to them and to enhance their control of various parts of the world, the population, the economy, the territory. We can talk about what the law says and what morality says and all of these things, but in the end, it is strength that talks. It is power that talks, and Israel is going to use whatever power it has in order to cause disaster for its neighbors, to keep its neighbors in check, and also to use its power to enhance, to enlarge its territory and increase its own power over its neighbors. And that's the same applies to the United States, which, as I said before, is just one is the extension of the other.
Well, Elijah Magner, Israel has sounded the alarm over Iran on so many occasions when it comes to its civilian nuclear program. A quick question that comes about during these times where we're looking at the revival of the JCPOA, if there's even a point of saying the revival if it's not dead yet, is why doesn't the U.S. just make the political decision to get back into the deal that the U.S. pulled out from in the first place in order to, in their eyes, eliminate any chances that there may be in their eyes again for Iran to pursue any type of weaponization of their program, which will then, by default, leave only Israel with nuclear weapons in West Asia?
Because when you give the Americans a finger, they won't. The problem is Iran is negotiating the Americans in good faith, but the Americans and the Europeans are in 2018. One is the American, Donald Trump, just threw away the JCPOA, and the Europeans find themselves withdrawing from Iran and not abiding by their signature. So you are dealing with Western organizations that just want to impose their will and dominate whoever country that is ready to be dominated. Iran is not on the list of dominated countries for the West. And by showing its rejection of the U.S. supremacy and the U.S. control and hegemony, Iran became the enemy. So whatever Iran is doing and offering, the Americans are trying to have a deal where they keep having the upper hand over the Iranians. And Iran is trying to say that we want a deal where we are both equal, where this is the big mistake Iran is doing, because the Americans are not interested in becoming an equal partner in this deal, because they are not a viable partner. They want the upper hand, and they want to make sure that they can return to the sanctions against Iran, because you are dealing with Western, not international organizations like the IAEA, that brings out of the hat all the rabbits they want against Iran whenever they want, because they are pushed by the United States. And then you negotiate a peace, a deal that the JCPOA is saying, I agree to control my nuclear program that is weapon-free. And they say, no, but we want to impose sanctions on your institutions, because whenever we want, we can cripple your economy. So you are both talking different languages, and it is like you don't understand each other, because the American side is not ready to sit on the table as an equal partner. The Americans want the upper hand. That is the point.
Okay, we got about 30 seconds to give to you, Paula Rudy. You had a statement coming out from the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak that was interesting, that said Iran can transform itself into a nuclear power and it's too late to stop it by surgical attack. Of course, he goes on to say, again, talk about the timeline here, that it will take Iran 18 to 24 months in order to reach that, what did he call it, treating metal, uranium, and picking it. Well, he talked technically there. You know, you have the threat, and then, but it takes a couple of years, even though the threat is going to take a couple of weeks. Never understood how they always talk about weeks away, and we can go back to 20 years ago up to now. Anyways, what is interesting about this is the fact that you have Israel, who is very much against this JCPOA revival. Why would Israel really be against this if it feels threatened in any shape or form by Iran pursuing, again, in its eyes, a nuclear weaponization program?
Well, the answer is that Israel does not feel threatened by it, and it considers that it can take whatever measures it needs in order to remain more powerful, especially in terms of nuclear weapons. It's not really afraid of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons, most of all because of the policies of the government. The government of Iran has said repeatedly that it has no interest in acquiring nuclear weapons and is not pursuing any.
Okay.
Nuclear weapons. So this, well. I think this is not an issue.
Thank you very much for that. Paul Arudi there, former U.S. government advisor. And thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. Both of you, thank you for your input. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tapway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Dear sisters and brothers, welcome to IRB English Radio. This is Q&A on Islamic belief, where we shed light on your main questions.